up on it. So, you know, they're going to want to know if they see you with it. That's all. N2RDB, back to net.
Matt Bravo Zulu. Yeah, Bravo Zulu, recognize that. Tim, let me ask you this question. From your point of view right now, of all the services that a scanning person can use to listen to a police, fire, ambulance, emergency services, and so on, ham radio, citizen band, and whatever, what percentage of those services and which ones are primarily going digital? And I presume very few of them are now, you can't hear the voice, so to speak, once they've gone digital, because the digital demodulation technique is not open source, is my guess. So my first question, Tim, is from your point of view, what percentage are now or soon will be digital? And I presume the digitals are essentially not able to be listened to. N2RDB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, to the best of my knowledge, the primary agency that is going digital in this area, the Nassau County Police Department, I can't really say what they're doing in the city or how they use it. And, you know, that police officer who questioned me that night, and he asked me if my equipment received their frequencies, I told him, I said, well, even if I was listening to them, what am I going to do? I'm not a law enforcement officer, and I have no intention of interfering with your, you know, how you conduct your business. So, you know, you can listen, but what good is it going to do you? But yeah, NCPD is the main one in this area. You have a lot of business band stuff, and, you know, of course, there's amateur MURS. The fire departments are still in analog, rescue squads. So, yeah, there's stuff out there to listen to, and there's going to be for a long time. It's just mainly law enforcement that's changing over that I know of. Now, if you have a trunking scanner, then you can listen to, you know, certain municipalities share the same frequencies, but they have, they're divided up into, you know, talk groups by department. So if you have a scanner that can, you know, that has that trunking capability, then it's more useful. Otherwise, you're just going to hear everything at once. N2RDB.
WHYOR with another comment.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Rich is next, and Joey after that. Rich? Bravo Zulu, go right ahead with your further comment.
Yes, I've been a ham radio operator since 1962. I can't believe it. And a scanner listener since, I guess, 72, whatever. So I'm pretty well versed in scanner history and where it's going. I would say 80% of the SWAT teams, hostage negotiation, all that stuff that used to be quote-unquote the most interesting stuff has all gone digital. Even in the smallest municipalities. As everybody knows, Nassau County's gone digital. But the smaller municipalities across the country, it's very expensive to do this switch, to acquire all new stuff. And in Manhattan, I don't know if the precincts will ever go digital, because it's so much happening so quickly all the time that, you know, I think their attitude is, you know, who cares, you know? It's not going to help anybody commit a crime. Anyway, commit a crime. But in terms of which scanner you should buy, let me let it drop. It's actually much easier now to listen to good stuff, quote unquote, good stuff. You know, car chases, if that's your idea of good stuff, and things like that on the internet. I would think this is the worst time in history, and it gets worse hour by hour, to buy a scanner. when everything is on the internet, and not only that, you could customize when you want an alert to notify you that something's going on, and you really can't do that by, let's say, number of listeners with a scanner. I don't care how fancy a scanner. I have a digital trunking scanner, and I could listen to everything on the internet that I could listen to on my scanner. Let me let it drop again. So in terms of which one you should buy, I would think, and I would listen to, let's say, get an app called Police Scanner. That's the name of the app, Police Scanner. It's the best out there. Play around with it for a while and see if you'd want to buy a scanner at all. That's number one. Then number two, if you do, make sure it's a digital trunking scanner so you can follow signals between towers. And the last is a question. Are we as ham radio operators allowed to be talking on our radio in a moving vehicle? As a license, the license in the car, are we allowed to do that? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that one's been discussed a few times, and the answer is not super simple. In many places in New York State, I think you're allowed to talk on your radio while driving, even though a cell phone is absolutely not allowed to be used that way. Ham radio operators seem to be able to use that. They seem to have permission to do it, except in New York City. In New York City, I think you're absolutely not allowed to be in a moving vehicle, even with a ham radio with a license in your pocket. That's what I hear. But you're going to hear a lot of other answers to that one. There's no direct answer on that one. Let's see. Was it Bravo Zulu? Yeah. Bravo Zulu is a guy we just heard, and I think it's Joe that wants to give us some more information. W2RYY, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
Okay, this is like, QYW. I don't know how much interest you have in this, but here's something to think about. Right now, most of New York City is on analog channels about 470 megahertz, called a D-band. So then you can pull out a scanner and listen to that kind of stuff probably almost all the time. Any sensitive stuff is probably digitized, or they lose, another form of communications other than a radio system for communications back and forth. Nassau County is digitized trunking. Suffolk Police is trunking analog, 800 megahertz. Some of this stuff is digital. But here's something long-term to think about. There is frequency space available in a 700 meg LTE band, which I think the FCC will eventually try to push more and more of these stations up to, because it is allocated up there. Whether they get the money or the agencies get the money to do that or not, I don't know. But I don't know if there's any scanning capabilities to be able to decode stuff in that band right now. So you may spend money now and be able to enjoy it temporarily for a couple of years, but maybe sometime soon, maybe within 10 years, maybe more, maybe less, it may all start to disappear on you. Even if you go out and buy a digital trunking scanner now, who knows how long that format's going to last, and those people are going to stay on the frequency bands they're currently on. So that's just something to think about. Nothing lasts forever. And with that, over to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think there are a number of fairly enthusiastic people, ham radio-like people, who have developed a significant interest, serious interest in scanning. I presume there is a scanner net somewhere. In other words, either on whether or not it's on the Landmark repeater or other repeaters, is there a particular net that meets once a week, once a month, or whatever, that the serious scanner people go to in order to discuss various details like this? Anybody can give me that information as to where and when that net is? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, radioreference.net.
N2RDB, W2LIE.net.
Yeah, also on Facebook Live, Scanner Masters. They do, every Wednesday night, they do a 1 hour of Facebook Live about scanners and whatnot from scannermasters.com.
Okay, the very first one was Was it RDB.net? Give me that one again, the very first one.
The biggest source of scanner information is radio reference. I'm pretty sure it's .net, maybe .com, but it's definitely radio reference.
Okay, thank you, radio reference. Alrighty. I can tell we can talk about scanning for a long time. Let's see now. Is somebody else in another bit of information to add?
N2RDB does.
RDB, go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, there's a website, W2LIE.net. You should still be active.
Okay, thank you. Now we're going to go over to Fred, KC2 Oboe Echo Sierra, if you're still there. K2RIW, go ahead, Fred.
2H for a fill.
2H for a fill, okay. Go ahead.
2H. On this very repeater, 14685, W2VL, first and third Thursdays of the month at 8:30 p.m. is the scanner net. The scanner net, first and third Thursdays, right here.
Okay, thank you. Was that U Lu NY2H?
Yes, it is, and the people on Echolink won't hear me, but everybody else will.
Yeah, the trouble is, I was, you were talking first, or maybe the repeater picked up slow, and then squeezing, so we were just barely hearing the last letter. No prefix, no number, and just the last letter. So, by whatever means you're coming in, you might have to squeeze, wait a second, and then start talking. Okay, let's see if Fred is still with us. KC2, Oboe Echo Sierra. Go right ahead, Fred. You were the next on the list, K2RIW.
Good evening to all. My question to installing an antenna on a fiberglass RV roof. What I want to use an NMO type. What type of antenna do you recommend?
Okay, some of you guys have done pretty elaborate mobile installations, but an NMO like mount, which normally is connected to a piece of sheet metal and provides the ground for the antenna. And when you're mounting it on fiberglass, it's going to act differently. It's not a showstopper, but it's going to act differently, and maybe some extra work is required with the copper tape or whatever in the right place. So anybody who's actually done that, installed an antenna on a fiberglass roof of a vehicle with an NMO mount, give us your call letters right now, K2RIW. Maybe somebody who has done it is not present tonight. If you just did it and made belief that the roof is sheet metal, even though it's made out of fiberglass, it's going to work. You might develop some extra standing wave ratio, and you can measure that and find out. And even if you do measure extra standing wave ratio, there's a number of ways you can improve that and correct it. So the antenna is going to work, but the pattern is going to be a little bit different. The standing wave ratio is going to be a little bit different. I would give it a go, and you can always make modifications later by adding copper foil and copper foil in just the right place. It may only require a couple of ground plane radials made out of copper foil flat against the roof, either on the inside or on the outside of the vehicle, if you want to make that level of correction. But I think there's only a 50-50 chance you're going to need any correction. I give you a medium chance that it's going to work if you just make believe that your fiberglass is metal, because you can't stop an antenna from radiating just because you're providing a counterpoise in a different manner. KC2 OES, K2RIW. You're allowed to ask more questions if you want to, Fred. Go ahead.
Yeah, Roger. From what I've read, you know, I can use the sheeting on the inside. I have an area that's maybe 12 inches by 16 inches underneath in this area. Very accessible, easily done. As far as any gauge, or should I make it as big as possible? Question.
If it was a 450 antenna, where quarter wavelength is what, 4 inches or something like that? Let me think now. One third of 19, around 7 inches. So you could make a number of ground plane radials approximately 7 inches long out of copper foil. And that's going to give you most of the performance you would get out of making the whole darn roof out of one great big piece of copper foil. So that's the minimum, 3 or 4 radials, a quarter wavelength long out of copper foil. And anything more you add beyond that is gravy. But you're going to get 90% of the performance out of just putting down 3 or 4 radials, in my opinion, Fred. KC2OES, K2RIW.
Roger, in case I forgot to mention, it's a 2-meter 440 dual-band antenna that I want to purchase. I'm using an Yaesu 8800. So just sheet metal alone, trapped under the locking nut, would that suffice?
Of the right size, yes. And it doesn't have to be, you know, a 16th-inch piece of aluminum. The so-called sheet metal could be copper foil, copper tape. So, because the RF energy only flows through the top 10,000th of an inch of the metal, aluminum or copper. The top 10,000th of an inch is all that's doing the work. Any greater thickness is making a mechanical difference, but not electronic. So therefore, copper foil tape can do the job very well. Over to you, Fred. KC2OES, K2RIW.
Okay, so with that said, the size of the sheet metal that I add to the underside trapped under the locking nut wouldn't matter in size as long as it's there, period, correct?
From the center of the NMO mount to the edge of your sheet metal, you would like that to be a minimum of quarter wavelength at the lowest frequency. Your lowest frequency in your case is 2 meters. So you'd like there to be 19-inch radius. Now, the 19-inch radius could be a number of 3 or 4 strips of copper foil tape as a ground plane radial. Or you could make it a great big sheet that's at least 19 inches to the edge. That'll give you the maximum performance. It doesn't have to be a solid sheet of metal. 3 or 4 radials of copper tape, 19 inches long, is going to give you most of the performance you would get out of the whole darn roof made out of copper. Over to you, Fred, K2RIW.
Okay. What about the length of the wave of the antenna, 5/8, half, a quarter, etc.?
That almost doesn't matter. There's two halves to the antenna. The bottom half is the counterpoise. That's what the RF energy is being pushed against, so to speak. And the radiator section. The radiator section could be quarter wave, 5/8 wave, 2 waves, whatever. That's a separate situation. Don't necessarily have to extend the length of the counterpoise simply because you've got a longer length of radiator. There's two separate functions. And the length of the radiator doesn't create a wave that flows over the counterpoise system, if you know what I mean. You divide and conquer. There's two separate sections, and make each one do what you want, all by itself, ignoring the other one. Over to you, Fred, K2RIW.
I guess I got enough information there, but if somebody's got a definite suggestion as far as a type of mount or antenna that might... this is roughly about 9 feet off the ground, roughly, by the way.
Yeah, the NMO type of mount is very popular on sheet metal. I presume it's going to also work on fiberglass, but there I don't know for sure. And whether or not you'd have to back it up with a sheet of metal stronger to make sure you're not biting into the fiberglass, because it's the connector, the NMO is made to bite into metal, and the fiberglass is not as strong as the metal. Maybe you might have to put some metal there for physical reasons, not electronic reasons. I've been giving you an electronic answer. The quarter wave ground plane radials are there to stop RF energy from flowing down the outside of the transmission line. If you had a pure fiberglass, small diameter mounting structure where the antenna is mounted to, and you did nothing else, no other metal in the roof of the vehicle, then your transmission line will be hot with RF energy. And so there's just another radiator at some other crazy angle, if you know what I mean, which could either help or hurt, depending on which angle and azimuth that you're looking at the vehicle with. So putting down the ground plane radials primarily stops that from happening. You don't have a hot transmission line outer surface anymore. And after that, the radiator does its job. So once you do this mount, come back and tell us how well it worked physically, how difficult it was to do, and how well it worked electronically when you get a chance to test it. So come back and let us know what you would discover with it, because there are other people who would probably like to know this. They may be considering a similar installation. KC2OES, K2RAW.
Yeah. One quick question. The shape of the area where, if I look into this area, it's an upside-down U ceiling and the walls. I can get the 19 inches that you're talking about, but does the shape have any effect on how the ground plane works?
The answer to that is almost no. The length is all that counts. You'll note that a whole lot of antennas, like for instance a station master antenna, has ground plane radials that are slanted down at a 45 degree angle, and they're a quarter wavelength long. Now, the shape doesn't matter. The electrical length is what matters. Over to you, Fred.
Okay, very good. Just to be clear, it's 19 inches from center is what you're mentioning, correct?
Yes. That'll give you coverage on 2 meters, and that it's a quarter wavelength on 2 meters, and it will also be, let's see now, 3/4 wavelength at 450. And there's a little bit of a fuzziness to that one. By that I mean, by the time you get to 450, the extra capacitance, which is, let's say, an inch wide. Whenever you make a antenna element out of... Over to you, Fred, K2RIW.
Yeah, I understand that. So basically, I have plenty of room from what I'm gathering based on the information you gave me to make 4 radials, or I can do an entire very thin sheet if I have to. I just have to make sure that the center is under the locking nut to ground. And the other part is basically going to be put on with construction adhesive.
Okay. You're going to use construction adhesive as opposed to using copper tape that's already got the glue on it. It's your choice. Okay, the next person in our list was Rich, November 2, Bravo Zulu. Go ahead, Rich, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, it's Whiskey 2. Whiskey 2, baby. My odyssey to try to get back on the low bands now for about 6 months, especially Dr. Roy, who has been so helpful and so patient in trying to help me in this quest. Well, I finally got back on the low bands from my one-story condo that, you know, they don't allow anything on the roof, anything on the lawn or whatever. I first tried by modifying my screwdriver antenna by replacing the whip with a 66-foot long wire as the whip, the elongated whip. That didn't work. And then I tried, what was the next? I made a loop antenna, 17 feet in circumference, and I was very disappointed with it as a receiving antenna. And Dick, I made the capacitor, the variable capacitor, out of what you suggested. Let me let it drop. I made it out of 2 4-inch by 4-inch sheets of aluminum flashing, and place them as humanly close as possible to each other, and move them around, and then did whatever I could with those, and still I hardly heard anything on it, and I really didn't want to use my 440 to test to see whether it would load or arc over. Well, last night I wound a 9-to-1 un-un, attached to it a 66-foot long piece of wire that sloped from my front door up to the roof of my car, which was about, I don't know, 40 feet in front of my front door, and then back down onto the parking lot, and both 440 and 80 lit up. I got a 20 over on 80, I got a 10 over on 40, and I'm back in ham radio low band heaven. Go ahead, Dick.
My goodness, that's an interesting approach. The 9-to-1 onion, of the two output wires, one of them goes to your 66-foot long, or the piece of wire that goes over the vehicle and then into the parking lot. What did the other lead go to? Did you have a local ground, so to speak, over to you on that one, Rich, K2RIW?
Well, two of the leads, because there were three wires that got wound together around the toroid, two of them get soldered together, and I should say four of them get soldered together, and then the other one does go to my counterpoise, which is my 9-foot ground rod.
Very good. Huh. Now, because this is stretching from your front door over the vehicle and into the parking lot, I presume this is a temporary antenna that you install at nighttime. It doesn't stay there all day long. But it sounds like it's working very well. Oh, amazing. Both on, you've used it in the receiving mode and you're happy. You've transmitted into it and you've gotten some reports already. Rich, go ahead.
I've on 80 to join a net on Sunday mornings in Connecticut. And then the other guy, I think, was from North Carolina or something. One guy from Tennessee who could barely hear me, he kept on saying, "You got to put more fire in your wire," which I never heard in all these years. Fire in my wire. But yeah, now when I got home today from dinner, what I did was I was able to make sort of a loop about 8 to 10 feet off the ground. Instead of, going from my car over one short tree, over another short tree, and I thought because now 80% of the wire was off the ground and higher than my quote-unquote sloper, as Dr. Roy generously named it. I don't think you can quite call a slope or something that goes to the roof of your car, but anyway, I thought the antenna would way outperform the way it was just sloping up to my car then into the parking lot, but it didn't. And Dick, you had commented once that height is not all that important in this quote-unquote sloper antenna, which turned out to be the case.
Yeah, if you had a pure horizontal dipole, completely parallel to the ground, mounted a few feet off the ground, it's going to give you relatively poor performance. But as long as you raise some portion of the wire so that a portion of it has inverted V-like characteristics or some extra altitude, you start picking up a significant amount of vertical polarization in the end effect. In other words, in the direction of the wire, you're picking up some good vertical polarization, which propagates very, very nicely toward the horizon. Whereas broadside, the signal is not going to be so good. So at least in certain directions, you're going to do pretty well. Altitude does help. And now, if I was using an inverted V, and if the inverted V was set up east-west, and I'm talking to a station that's either east or west of me, he hears primarily vertical polarization. And if I took that inverted V, which used to have a center at 30 feet off the ground, and now I mount it 50 feet off the ground, you're not going to see very much of a difference. Whereas if I was looking at the antenna broadside, I'm looking at the horizontal polarization, they're going to do rather poor at all altitudes, but it's going to do better at higher altitude. So portions of the pattern improve with altitude, the end effect portion. The bird's eye portion is always going to be a little bit lower in performance, and their altitude is more required. I wonder if that makes some sense. That's a bunch of opinions. I haven't actually done this. Over to you. I think it's a Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, K2RAW.
Yeah, it's Whiskey. It started out as WN, Whiskey Nancy 2 Bravo Zulu Zulu, went to Whiskey Bravo 2 Bravo Zulu Zulu, and when I got the extra about 30 years ago, I saw that W2BZ, so for CW I shortened it. But anyway, so here's the, yes, and so here is, and by the way, it's very critical. Tuner, it doesn't work without the tuner. And the adjustments to make this thing go below, let's say, 2 to 1 or 1.5 to 1 with the tuner are micro, fine adjustments. And sometimes it takes me like 10 minutes to get this thing, you know, so where the radio shows that I'm below, let's say, 1.5 to 1. Here's my question. This 66 feet of wire, 18-gauge single strand, not single strand, but solid core wire, is wound around a spool, which I wind in when I'm done at night. What is the effect if I, let's say, unwound 30 feet of this, but left the rest of the wire wound around the spool on top of my car? What effect does that wire have of still being, let's say, 30 feet of it still being wound on the spool? Go ahead, Dick.
Once you've got 30 feet of it wound on the spool and you do hit proper tuning with your antenna tuner, you're going to get close to the same performance, but it's going to be a higher Q antenna. The persnicketiness of tuning it is going to get worse. So, as it is right now, you've got some real critical tuning, and maybe you're going to want to add a vernier knob to one of those variable capacitors, if that's what it is, or a variable inductor. You may want to add a vernier to it to make the fine tuning a little bit easier. You're end feeding a piece of wire with a mysterious layout as far as the local earth is concerned. And so you've got a relatively high Q structure. That's the combination of your onion, and this particular piece of wire. It's an antenna that doesn't want to resonate all by itself. Although, when you get a chance, I recommend you talk to the other Rich. Why can't I think of his call list now? UPS, KTUPS. Guarantee Rich, KTUPS, will also have some other suggestions for you. When you hear him on, grab him and discuss the situation you've got, Rich. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu, K2RIW.
Dick, I couldn't imagine any more critical tuning. So if that's what, I'll try it. You know, I'll try leaving half of the wire still on the spool, sitting on top of my car, but I just couldn't imagine. I mean, I'm talking, you know, you could blow on the inductor coil knob and this thing will go out of tune. So what about a choke, a one-to-one choke? Do you think that would add anything to this circuit, W2BZ?
It's worth a try, but I doubt it. Now, your antenna tuner, what is your antenna tuner? Maybe it is the, first of all, if I understand correctly, the screwdriver arrangement, I think, is part of your system. I think it's I don't know if the screwdriver is still there, but you're using an antenna tuner, and your antenna tuner, when you're adjusting it, are you adjusting an inductor, are you adjusting a capacitor, or are you adjusting both? Is it an L network, is it a Pi network? Tell me what your antenna tuner is and whether or not the screwdriver is still there. Over to you, Rich, K2RIW.
Yeah, the screwdriver isn't still there, and also the variable capacitor, the air capacitor, I was talking about that. I'm sorry if I bungled this all into one thing, but that was for the loop. That was for my magnetic loop, where I said that variable capacitor that you suggested, you know, which was just two sheets of metal. I have two sheets of aluminum. They're both 4-inch by 4-inch square, and I mounted them in such a way so they barely touch. They can actually be turned away from each other, and also they could be separated, you know, up to, let's say, 1 inch from each other. Right now, they're as close as I could get them physically, and I could vary where they are in relationship to each other in terms of turning them around an axis, but I could tell just by what I'm hearing that it's not working too well. So that has nothing to do with the long wire. The screwdriver is out of the picture now. I asked Roy if he thinks that I could tune the magnetic loop with the screwdriver antenna, and he didn't seem to drop. So no, this is a MFJ tuner. It has a roller. You know, it's an inductor coil. With a transmitter capacitor and a transmitter capacitor and a tuner capacitor. What is it labeled? I am going absolutely blank. Anyway, there are three adjustments. Keep it short. There are three adjustments. The large inductor coil adjustment, and then the transmitter inductor, and then the input inductor, input capacitor.
Okay, it sounds like it could be a Pi network, where you've got a tuning capacitor and a loading capacitor and a roller inductor. So you've got a variable inductor, a variable capacitor. If it's on the output, they call it the loading capacitor. And if there's another capacitor input, they call it the tuning capacitor. So you've either got a Pi network or a L network from what I'm hearing. Over to you, Rich, K2RIW.
Exactly, that's exactly what I have. I don't know enough to know whether it's an L or a Pi network.
Okay. Sounds like you're making progress. You've got a difficult requirement of where the antenna can't show, and yet you want to be on HF frequencies. There are various compact antennas that you can buy that, you know, they look like a loop that's all 6 or so feet in diameter. And they got a very fancy tuning arrangement, but some of these are pretty expensive, and you could build a homebrew version of those. So what you've got right now is inexpensive. It's giving you some pretty good performance, although very persnickety tuning. I still think you might end up on some of these so-called compact loop antennas. There's a number of commercial products like that, and if you don't want to spend the great big bucks for these things, building a homebrew version of it. And the nice thing about those antennas is that you might be able to operate them from inside your apartment, and nothing is outside the house that shows. Keep us informed as to how your experiments run with this thing, Rich. Whiskey 2, Mavo, here we go. Boy, oh boy, I can't even read my own writing. Bravo Zulu, K2IW, any final comments? Over to you, Rich.
The final comment is, I did build the loop, and it's not even a compact loop. It's 17 feet in circumference, and it's 6 feet in diameter, 17 feet in circumference, and I have the matching loop that is 3 feet in circumference. I built that already, and that's what I was describing when I said I tried your homebrew air capacitors, and they didn't work out too well. So my next thing is to purchase a capacitor. Unfortunately, and I've been talking to Andy about this too, CDL, unfortunately, you know, the vacuum air capacitors, they're very expensive. So I think I might just try to get a hold of a regular air capacitor at less expense and play around with that. But no, I have built that antenna. But so far, what's got me on the air, and just as of last night, is the long wire going into, and I don't think it's an unun. I think I read on the internet that it's really not an unun. It makes... So those are I don't care what antenna it is, as long as I could speak to some guys and get back on my beloved CW. Back to net, go ahead.
WA2CDL is listening in. Can I make a comment, Dick?
Yeah, sure, Ken, Andy. Don't buy a vacuum variable right away, Rich. They're very expensive, and the only thing a vacuum variable buys you is that it's a compact capacitor that can take very high voltage without arcing over. And you only need that if you're running a whole lot of power and you would ordinarily arc over. Your variable capacitor two plates that you can pivot and change their spacing. That's, if you've done it, if you've used reasonable materials to construct that, that's going to give you the same performance as the vacuum variable. And if you buy an air variable and at low enough power that you don't arc over, that can work very well. Don't buy the vacuum variable and spend the great big bucks. If other kinds of capacitors you use of the exact same number of picofarads don't give you performance, then the vacuum variable is not going to create any extra magic in capacitance, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Andy, the B2CDL, K2RIW. And how many vacuum variables have you owned, Andy? Go ahead, Andy.
Well, that's my comment. And there's a number of factors here without taking up too much time. I just came out of a restaurant and I heard Rich talking about his loop. First of all, before I mention anything about his loop, there's a number of interesting articles that I've read in QST magazine, the latest ones. I don't have the issues in front of me, but there's one which has particularly caught my eye because it's an antenna that's designed for apartment dwellers. And according to the results that the guy was talking about, he said it worked out very well. It's simply running a wire along the perimeter of one of his rooms in his apartment. And I'm not sure if it's a folded dipole or if it's an extended dipole, but it's just a long wire that's run around that perimeter connected to an antenna tuner. And he's got an interesting way of matching it. So I got to get the article on that. So maybe, and Dick, I'll throw it over to you as an easy way for him to get on because of his restrictions and everything else which I know about. Maybe this is the way to go for the time being, just to get him on the air. And then he could play around with loops later on because there's a number of factors in regard to that. So what do you think, Dick? I have to find the QST article, but it's specifically mentions the people who live in an apartment and they cannot put an antenna outside at all. Back to you.
Those can be useful articles, and they might work in Rich's case. And if you've got enough dynamic range, enough variable capacity to your antenna tuner, almost any antenna of almost any size can be forced into resonance. And once it does resonate on your frequency and give you a reasonable impedance match to your receiver and transmitter, it's got to work. Its exact physical length isn't the main determining factor. If you can make the antenna physically a half wavelength long, if it's, say, for instance, a half wave dipole, that does give you a leg up. You now don't need any fancy tuning. But other sizes of other kinds of antennas with an antenna tuner that has enough hair on its chest can be made to work. You're electronically resonating the antenna, and once it resonates, it will radiate, and it will receive. Okay, we've gone quite late compared to the way we normally do. Keep up those experiments and let us know. You're getting a lot of hands-on experience with antenna building and antenna tuning here, Rich. And so it's a fascinating story to listen to as you proceed. We're now going to go over to Dr. Roy, AC2GS, who's going to give us the mailbag and science talk and some puzzles. And as I mentioned earlier, Roy, the August issue of Scientific American magazine is getting into, has an article which is being funded. A number of multi-million-dollar contracts are being, let me drop this. A number of multi-million dollar contracts are being issued by National Aeronautics and Space Administration to these various groups that are experimenting with thrusting devices, rocket engines, that don't emit chemistry or don't emit electrons. They're so desperate for finding some other method of getting thrust, they're willing to take some pretty big chances of funding these dark horses, these long shots, if you know what I mean, because they really want thrust in a way that doesn't use chemistry, because with chemistry, the fuel that gives you the thrust is the stuff that you're throwing away, and therefore you get very little time out of it, if you know what I mean. You get the, you know, you get 180 seconds worth of thrust, and you've used up a zillion tons of fuel. They're looking for some alternative, and they're desperate enough to issue multi-contracts for a megabucks each, where people are doing this research, and that's what's in the August issue of Scientific American. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy. AC2GS, if you're there, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy. Okay. Maybe Roy got called away with a phone call or some other event in his house. One more call for Roy, and if not, we'll go over to Paul, at least temporarily, if not permanently. AC2GS, are you still there, Roy? K2RIW.
Dick, I have some information.
Go right ahead, Andy. Maybe you know something about, has the particular input that Roy normally used not operational tonight? You got it, Andy.
I was listening to the news earlier. I thought that part of Brooklyn had a power failure due to the heat. So I'm not sure if he's affected by that. It's a possibility. They did say something on the news about sections of Brooklyn. I don't know if he's involved with that, possibly.
NY2H, I've been chatting with him in the chat room. Just sent him a message, but I chatted with him within the last couple of minutes.
Interesting, Lou. And so he sounded normal. Okay, send him a message now and ask him, does he have a... by the way, if he has a power outage, can he still get on the chat room? Maybe he has an uninterruptible power supply on his computer, but maybe not one on his transmitter for his rig. Over to you, Lou.
Hello, guys.
There he is. Hey, Roy. We've given a couple of calls for you. Did you have a power outage? AC2GS, K2RIW.
No, Dick. It was just one of the toggle buttons of my software-defined radio wasn't toggled correctly, so it didn't activate the transverter. I'm back online. What I tried to say the last time, I thought I got through, but I didn't, was that NASA has good reason to be desperate. The economics of propellant-based rocket engines are not cost-effective unless you're bringing back tons of helium-3 or something equally incredibly expensive. Even if you were carrying carts of diamonds, you wouldn't pay for the flights back and forth. So, you know, a couple of $1 million here or there is chicken feed to these guys. They spend billions of dollars. So I think it's a reasonable investment on their part.
Makes sense. Now, right now they're pursuing the Mach effect, which means when you take two masses with some kind of an extending device in between them, like sheets of piezoelectric material, and you vibrate the two masses one against the other, the Mach effect, which is a theory, which I don't think has been proven, is that under certain conditions you move one of those weights and its mass goes down and therefore its momentum goes down. So if you can make the momentum go down in one direction and make the momentum come back up in the other direction of motion, you can get thrust out of something without dispensing material, without throwing material away. I'm starting off very skeptical, and I know that one of the universal rules that are true up until when it comes to Newtonian physics, one of the rules that are true is that the conservation of momentum is something that almost always exists. But there's one sort of exception to that. In the case of the Large Hadron Collider, as the material that you're accelerating starts getting closer and closer to the speed of light, the amount of mass it has increases. Therefore, the amount of force you have to apply to it in order to increase its velocity increases. So It would sound at first like a alternating gradient synchrotron. I mean, the Large Hadron Collider does have a way of changing the mass, therefore changing the momentum of a fixed amount of material. And obviously, that's too big an object in order to use as a rocket engine, but can you miniaturize it, and as you apply your force to accelerate the material that's now increasing in mass, it sounds like you could possibly get some thrust out of that without throwing material out the window, if you know what I mean. It's a long shot from my point of view, and pretty spooky stuff. In fact, the name of the article, I think, is something like the crazy experiments. Let me see. What's the name of the article here, if I can find it? The Good Kind of Crazy. That's the name of the article, The Good Kind of Crazy. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, K2IW. Do you believe there's a way of modulating the momentum or the mass of a piece of material without literally chipping it away, if you know what I mean? Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Well, ultimately, I believe in the conservation of momentum, and accelerators still operate on that principle. The conservation of momentum is that momentum is conserved as long as you don't put any energy in or take any energy out. And accelerators, almost by definition, put a lot of energy in. It's all that additional kinetic energy that it accelerates the particle that acts as inertial mass. Equals mc squared. You know, the energy that you're putting to speed up those little hadrons has to go somewhere. It goes as a mass equivalency.
Okay. So I think you're saying the Mach effect or the Hadron effect, when the material is getting close to the speed of light that you're accelerating, you do get a change in mass or momentum because you're putting in energy. So if you can modulate the energy that's contained within a mass, it sounds like you can modulate its momentum, in which case maybe there is a engine capable, a rocket engine capable of giving you thrust without throwing away material. Up till now, they claim that they've got a few working models, and whether or not it's really working the way they expect, because they're only getting micro-newtons of force out of it, and is it a secondary effect or is it real, is now in question. And as you may know, they also have been a number of experiments where you take something that looks like a large resonating cavity, and you bounce a lot of RF energy, microwave energy inside, and they think they're getting some micro-newtons of thrust out of that. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, we even did a story. The Germans took that type of design and meticulously tested it, and they tended to believe that it was not true propulsion. It was simply interactions with local magnetic fields in the test area.
Yeah, I was worried about that when I read those articles. I was worried about the fact that the current you're pouring in through the wiring, depending on how you lay out the wiring, and is it twisted pair, is it coaxial, and so on, could give you local magnetic fields fighting against the local magnetic fields at the Earth or other equipment in the laboratory, and therefore you could be looking at a secondary effect as opposed to true thrust. And one of the best ways to confirm a theory, to make a proof of concept experiment, is to have somebody else duplicate your equipment in some other location and get the same result. And if other people duplicate your equipment and they get a drastically different result or no result at all, then you start asking a whole lot of very poignant questions as to what's really going on here. AC2GS, K2IW.
Well, that's the scientific method that has gotten us the technological marvels that we have today. You know, they tried it with that drive. They tried it with cold fusion. You know, one of the earliest problems was it was rather simple to reproduce the experiment. And everyone else who did that got different results. And it goes even way back to, I once did a story about the infamous poly water, which was just in polluted lab water with the material inside capillary glass and dirt from other things. And people did a meticulous repetition of the experiment and got different results. So that's what you really want. You want people to publish exactly what they did, what they got, and give other people the opportunity in an unbiased way to repeat their work and either to agree with it or to disagree with it and find the flaws.
Okay, I sure hope somebody has some success with a substantial amount of thrust. You need more than micronewtons. Micronewtons and years of using it maybe will get you there. But if you can come up with a rocket engine that doesn't throw away material, then they stand a chance of taking these very long trips to the solar system and maybe even other stars. As it is right now with chemical systems, they're never going to get very much range out of human astronauts, and they're certainly not going to get to the nearest star without something that can give you thrust for a much more longer period of time. To get thrust for 180 seconds is not going to hack it. That's what the Saturn V gives you, something in that order. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
I hate to cite things like Star Trek, but Star Trek used to use this device called a buzzard collector, I believe was the term. It might be a real idea that someone has, where as you go through the fabric of space, you kind of collect the gaseous hydrogen that's in very low concentrations, but you collect it, you concentrate it, and then you use your own energy source to ionize it and propel it. That's the so-called ion drive of Star Trek. So that might be an option. You know, it doesn't cost that much to do these experiments. I doubt most of them that produce micronewtons. We're not looking for micronewtons. We're looking for kilonewtons, meganewtons. So, you know, they might find something. They might not. I think it's better to look into these things than to discount them entirely. Unless, in some cases where they make no sense whatsoever, then you're just throwing money away. But at this point, we really need a much more efficient method of going from point A to point B in space.
One other subject that I want to bring up from the previous week, and that is where we were talking about what is temperature. And we came to the conclusion that what temperature really is the average kinetic energy of the material that you're measuring the temperature of. And that kinetic energy, a big portion of it is translational kinetic energy. And we talked about translational as well as rotational. Well, rotational in some cases is almost non-existent, in my opinion. In the extreme case, if you take a container containing helium molecules, each helium molecule has something like 0.3 nanometer of radius of the outer electron shell. But the nucleus of the helium atom is 100,000 times smaller in diameter. If you made a model of a helium atom and you made it as big as the Wembley Stadium in London, which has a circumference of a kilometer, so the helium atom is as big as Wembley Stadium, the nucleus would be a BB in the middle of the Wembley Stadium. Because moment of inertia is something that's a function of radius squared, and the radius is 100,000 smaller, by definition, you can't have any significant amount of moment of inertia of individual helium atoms. Therefore, the rotational energy in helium atoms is so close to zero that you can ignore it. Now, when it comes to molecules, when you have a number of atoms joined together, now you've got nucleuses that have a certain distance between them, and you can have some substantial moments of inertia. So when it comes to circular kinetic energy, in some cases I think it's a lot lower than we've previously indicated by the words we used. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Well, Dick, it depends what you're talking about. Helium atoms, helium gas, which is helium atoms, because they don't form molecules, or at least they really, really don't want to. You got to really force the issue on them.